The Exchange podcast is sponsored by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucettesurvey.com. That's doucetesurvey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, the latest U.S. Ebola patient received a clean bill of health. Dr. Craig Spencer, who became ill after treating Ebola patients in West Africa, left Bellevue Hospital in New York City, receiving the now familiar symbolic hug from a prominent political figure meant to prove that the former patient is no threat whatsoever to the public. With that, New York and the U.S. have been declared, at least for now, Ebola-free. Still, American public health officials are readying for other possible cases, even as they emphasize how rare they expect Ebola to be here. And they're also trying to keep the focus on the crisis in West Africa, where they say Ebola victims require the utmost attention, both for humanitarian reasons and to keep the disease from spreading globally. Today in The Exchange, where we stand with Ebola now that some of the fears have died down, let's hear from you. What questions do you have about this disease, how we might handle it, including the issue of quarantines? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Dr. Jose Montero, Director of the Division of Public Health Services for the State Department of Health and Human Services. And Dr. Montero, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
Joining us from Massachusetts is Dr. Lindsay Baden, an infectious disease specialist with Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Baden, welcome. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Well, both of you, Dr. Montero, first, please, you know, about a month ago, Ebola and the less than a dozen cases here in this country led every newscast, the front page of every newspaper. Politicians were talking about it. Everybody was afraid of it. Since then, it seems, Dr. Montero, the fears have died way down. But I'd love to hear from both you and Dr. Baden, as public health professionals, what did you make of all that fear over so few cases in a country of more than 300 million people?
That's usually the history with infectious diseases. We as a society have this big fear of the unknown, and these exotic diseases come from Africa and everybody's going to die is the initial perception. We know that that's false. But in communication and risk communication is always tricky to address those particular societal concerns and reassure people. In today's society where we have access to so much media and social media, everybody makes up their own theories. And you can find them in the internet and you can drive and look for those to reassure yourself or your ideas. And that's the reality that we face. Certainly there is a role for leadership. And maybe because the timing, there were some people out there creating more noise than was necessary for this particular setting and management of the disease. Now we are in a different place. We know that we don't have cases in the U.S. and we are back to continue to work and prepare for this at the same time that we educate, reassure the public, and get ready for the unlikely event of a new case.
What do you think, Dr. Baden? And it wasn't just people going crazy on social media and trading rumors. It was, you know, established media like CNN and the New York Times. I mean, everybody was leading with this thing.
I mean, this is a serious disease, and we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that over 15,000 people have been infected in West Africa and more than 5,000 have succumbed to this illness. However, the risk of this illness outside of the epicenter or where the significant transmission is going on is substantially less. And I think, as Dr. Montero mentioned, the unknown is much scarier. And as we learn more about this disease and its transmission, and as we look more carefully at the prior experience with managing this, as these are not the first outbreaks. There have been more than two dozen outbreaks. And we actually know a fair bit about how to control and contain this. Hopefully, a greater sense of where the real risk is emerging, and we continue to learn how to contain this and where the real contagion is, which is not here.
What about, Dr. Baden, government officials? I mean, you had the president saying something, you had the CDC saying something else, then you had the governors in New York and New Jersey saying something else. I mean, people were looking for guidance from their elected officials, and sometimes that guidance varied depending on who was talking.
I mean, part of the challenge there is that there is a lot of fear and not as much definitive information, and it's managing the uncertainty is very challenging, and people want to feel that they're not at risk. However, we need to manage the risk and put into proper perspective and lead with the science and the evidence. And in terms of how political leaders or other leaders gather that evidence and respond, hopefully due deliberation and the science can emerge as the guiding principles. And earlier on, there was a lot more reaction. And hopefully we will have more action now based upon the evidence.
Yeah, and last question on this, and then I do want to ask you about some of the evidence, what we know, what we don't know, Dr. Baden. But Dr. Montero, the fact that these cases did happen in the midst of a very hot political year, what role do you think that played in sort of people feeling extra afraid or people feeling extra confused?
Unfortunately, at some times the political discussion was not the most constructive one. I'm talking in general around the country. Anything that can be built for political gain may drive the scientific agenda away from where it needs to be. Our elected leaders have to lead us as a society, and they need to rely on us as the scientific groups. Now, I know that in the role, and sometimes the public expectation, as Dr. Baden just said, is we need 100% certainty. Maybe we in the clinical community or the policy development understand the need for dealing with uncertainty. At the political level, reassuring a community that uncertainty is different and is judged different. We don't want our leaders to come and tell, well, we are working the best thing that we can. That is not the good answer for them, so they go to extremes. Some of them go to extremes. We didn't see that here in our state at our leadership level, but still at the campaign trail in many different places, it came out that way. That doesn't help. That doesn't help the system, and it doesn't help our community if we don't get scientifically based discussion at the political level.
Yeah, go
and
ahead, Dr.
We must redirect the discussion from a political discussion, from a soundbite discussion, to a scientific evidence-based discussion.
So let's
Otherwise,
Dr.
Baden, we do all of ourselves a disservice, including the risk to our local communities.
Well, I do have a couple specific scientific questions for you, Dr. Baden, on that. And first of all, why is Ebola so dangerous? I mean, how does it differ from other viruses?
Well, as time emerges, it may not differ as much as we think. Part of it is the unknown and managing the uncertainty, and the history of Ebola are outbreaks in Africa with upwards of 70 to 90% mortality.
Wow.
With no known therapy, no known vaccine. So it has the makings of a classic hot zone kind of imagery, which plays to the fears that you've been we've been discussing earlier. However, as we've seen in the management of the cases outside of the epicenter, the mortality in the U.S. has been much different with a single fatal case in Texas and multiple cases treated elsewhere with a much better result.
Why is that? Is there just certain medicines?
Well, as we learn more about this illness, which appears to be significant, the current disease in West Africa seems to have significant nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and significant volume loss. And it's very possible that a significant amount of the mortality may be related to such routine things as severe dehydration and then perhaps loss of bowel integrity and then gram-negative sepsis, things that we're used to treating and treating early and successfully.
Wow. That's
but
pretty profound,
West
isn't
Africa,
it?
In West Africa, there isn't the ability to easily give, you know, substantial amounts of IV fluid. For example, in a report from the Germany treatment unit in Hamburg recently published in the New England Journal, an aid worker was airlifted there and in the first 3 days from day 10 to 13 of illness had 30 liters of fluid loss. with successful fluid repletion, electrolyte repletion, and treatment of gram-negative sepsis, this individual survived.
And what is gram-negative sepsis, by the way, Dr. Baden?
So that's a routine bacterial infection that can occur from the intestines. And so with a severe diarrheal illness, one can have a leaky intestine.
So this is
And these are routine issues that we know how to treat if we're in a center that has the capability to treat these kind of complications.
So let me just make sure I get it right, Dr. Baden. So it's almost, you seem to be saying it's not so much that Ebola is so powerful and terrible, it's more that in West Africa they don't have the health system to deal with these symptoms that we can deal with pretty easily here in the United States, vomiting and diarrhea and so forth.
We don't know the definitive answer to that because this is still an evolving epidemic. But the data and the experience emerging over the last 2-3 months is consistent with a significant element of the morbidity and mortality likely related to dehydration. But it's very difficult to get definitive evidence from the epicenter given the fundamental limitations of their health structure.
One last question for you, Dr. Baden, and then I know you have to go. You serve as the infectious disease editor for the New England Journal of Medicine. You wrote an editorial recently about the quarantine debate. What are your concerns about quarantining health workers, Dr. Baden?
So I think a key issue to control this epidemic, we must obtain source control. We must control transmission, where transmission is going on, which is in West Africa, in the three countries with the greatest transmission. Secondary transmission outside of West Africa is extremely limited. In fact, if you look at the secondary cases outside of West Africa, they've only occurred in the context of healthcare workers taking care of patients in the extremes of illness, such as in Spain and in Texas. There have not been cases of transmission prior to illness or at early onset of illness, such as in the case in Texas or New York, where close contacts of individuals subsequently diagnosed did not subsequently become ill, as you opened the show with the New York case. The concern is that if we quarantine first responders, you know, these are our firefighters going to fight the fire. If we make an increased burden to the firefighters going to fight the fire, we will lose control of the fire, and that will be a bigger risk to us. So I think we have to think very carefully about the policies that we develop at the national level and at the state level and at different organizations to ensure that we encourage the ability to fight the fire at its source.
All right. And Dr. Baden, we will talk about state policies here in New Hampshire in just a moment. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Okay. Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, developments in Ebola preparations here in New Hampshire and around the country. Even though a lot of the controversy and fear has died down around Ebola, the country is still preparing for the possibility of other cases, even though the last U.S. Ebola patient, or the latest, I should say, was declared free of the disease just recently. The number for you to join us here in The Exchange with your questions and comments about this is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. My guest in the studio is Dr. Jose Montero, Director of the Division of Public Health Services at the New Hampshire Department of Department of Health and Human Services. And Dr. Montero, we just heard from Dr. Lindsay Baden. We were talking with him in our first segment. Again, he's at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Harvard Medical School. He had a big concern about quarantining healthcare workers. He said, look, we want to encourage as many people as possible to go to West Africa to help, as he put it, put the fire out at its source. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't disagree conceptually with what he has stated. Certainly, we need to control this in Africa, in those three countries or four countries, it depends how Mali goes. Before it comes here, that is the best option for all of us. And we know that they don't have the capacity to treat this patient. They don't have the hospital. So anything that we can do to help, it will be great. Now, when people come back, when the clinicians come back or people who have been in those countries come back, what do we do? There are many things that you can assess in levels of risk. And actually, that is what we have done. We look at the risk of exposure and what the chances are for each one of them of developing disease, and place them in three groups or categories. Some that we call low or negligible risk. So people who was there for business or doing some training here or there, we are going to monitor them when they come back for 21 days. So we're going to be measuring temperatures for them and making sure that they are healthy.
So if I were in, I'm sorry to interrupt, if I were in West Africa on a business trip or, you know, for some other tourist purpose or whatever, you would let me go to work, do whatever I do, go to the grocery store, but you would monitor me for 21 days.
Yes, twice a day for 21 days.
Okay.
We are getting the information about the people coming back from the three countries, from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. So we know who is coming back. So we talk to them as soon as they come in New Hampshire and follow them. Now, there are two other groups, some that is called some risk. So healthcare workers who have been working with those patients, maybe dealing specifically with touching patients, we are telling them, if you don't need to go to work, stay home. If they don't want to and they want to go to work, they can go to work. It's just... we're trying to combine the science of infection prevention with the science of risk communication. And how do we get the public and society to be comfortable? We don't want to put anybody at risk of being rejected at work, people to start saying we're not going to this place because so-and-so is there. So we're trying to balance those things. And then there is a high-risk group, people who was in contact with patients and maybe had a breach on their equipment. So we are interviewing them. If something like that happened, we are going to quarantine them at their house. That doesn't mean that they cannot go out of the door. They can still go and, I don't know, if they are into jogging, they can go around and this type of things. But we are going to have a closer look to those groups. So that's the way that we are managing the quarantine component. If somebody gets to test positive, certainly we're going to isolate them. And in general, we try to work all of this in an agreement perspective. I seldom like to issue orders. We have the authority at the Department of Health and Human Services to issue the orders, but I think that it's better if we get people to understand their risk and what it means for them, what it means for their families, what it means for their communities, and discuss the situation and find the best solution for all of us.
Well, and a little bit later in the program, we'll talk to a reporter at Maine Public Radio about the case of Casey Hickox there, the nurse who famously went for a bike ride. It made international headlines. There was an issue surrounding her possible quarantine there. But a couple questions more for you, please, Dr. Montero, about New Hampshire's protocols. So you said you're questioning people who come to New Hampshire from these infected countries. A lot of people who come from overseas, though, fly into Logan Airport. So is that up to Massachusetts officials? Even if that person, you know, lives in New Hampshire, most international flights are out of Logan.
Yeah, no. Actually, at the federal level, all patients coming from the three implicated countries have been redirected to, and they can only land in five airports in the U.S. So they will only come to Newark, JFK, Chicago, Atlanta, or Houston.
I see.
And from there, they will be interviewed by CDC personnel at that place. They're going to, they are getting a lot of educational material, specific guidance on how to get in touch with the local health department or the state health department where they are going. And right there, CDC fires us an email. Well, it's not an email, secure system, where we get the information about who is coming and when they arrive and what flights.
I see. So if somebody from Bedford, for example, was in West Africa on business, that person would only be allowed to fly into five specific airports where they would be interviewed by CDC upon exiting the plane.
Correct.
What about the idea that, you know, people sometimes don't really understand what their level of risk might have been, or sometimes people don't tell the truth? I mean, I'm not trying to find every eventuality here, but how do you manage that?
Well, it's a lot of education. Most of the people that is coming now are healthcare workers,
sure,
or late healthcare workers, so they do understand their risk. We have long conversations with them. CDC, when they come to the back to the U.S., have long conversations with them. And I think they do understand that it is in their best interest to stay healthy. And they don't want to expose their own families, their own loved ones, and put themselves at risk. So it is a long conversation. We need to work with people, and we need to believe that we are all doing the best for everybody.
Well, joining us now on the phone is someone who is directly working on this right now. Dr. Ed Marins is with us, Chief Medical Officer in charge of Ebola Preparedness at the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon. And Dr. Marins, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, and as I understand, you have a doctor, right, who is over in West Africa right now working with Ebola patients.
Well, we have a doctor that we really share in many ways with Dr. Montero, Elizabeth Talbot, who works in the state as a state epidemiologist and one of our infectious disease doctors, and is really an international expert in terms of epidemiology of these kind of illnesses, and it was really her calling in a lot of ways. So she is working at a very high level, not in direct patient care, but talking about how we do this on a very global level and how we focus it on West Africa. So she's over there now, but we have a cohort of other people that have heard this call from other doctors and nurses and people that want to heed the call to care and be involved in West Africa.
Now, and she is going to, as I understand, self-quarantine when she gets back.
That's correct. I think, you know, what we know, and I think Dr. Montero laid out really nicely the kind of the New Hampshire's state approach. Many of these aid agencies and organizations have their own protocols for self-quarantine and protocols that they've had for a while, as we know with Dr. Spencer when he returned from Doctors Without Borders, and his work was supposedly under a quarantine protocol that their program had run. So she has her own protocol and has made those decisions and certainly falls within the guidelines we have here.
We talked earlier, and I don't know if you heard this or not, Dr. Marins, but with Dr. Lindsay Baden, who is, again, at Brigham and Women's
Yes.
and Harvard Medical School, he has some real concerns that some states might be going overboard with quarantine requirements. He wants to really encourage health workers to go to West Africa and help, you know, stamp this thing down.
Yeah, I think I think in the early stages of anything, like we saw in the 1980s with HIV, there's a lot of misinformation, there's a lot of fear, and I think that's what we experienced. We even saw this in political rhetoric, which never really works well, and I think is all often misaligned. I think what we have to do is the work that we really have is to prevent this from spreading beyond West Africa and to help West Africa where it has had such an impact. So I think that, you know, we have to that's the real work we need to do. And I think the protocols that we have in place that have been laid out by the state of New Hampshire are good. I mean, Dr. Montero has really laid these out as high-risk people that have actually had contact and been exposed to fluids, which is the highest, most worrisome risk. But then there's those with some risk that have just been involved in routine care. So I think that, you know, I think that we will get some comfort level with this. I think the biggest challenge for all of us in the United States is that just getting up to speed and being prepared to do this requires a lot of people. And as we in New Hampshire know, we're sending people off to West Africa to do this work, and always the risk with sending people off to help is that they run the risk of coming back and being sick, and we want to be absolutely prepared for them if that's the case.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about the work that you're doing as the state's sort of Ebola hub, if I could call it that, although obviously people aren't expecting tons and tons of cases, maybe, hopefully, none. Let me also, though, Dr. Marins, invite our listeners again to join us. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, again, we're looking back at Ebola. Since a handful of cases occurred around the country, the fears seem to have died down, but there are guidelines and policies being put in place. We're finding out more, and we take your questions at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Dr. Marins, again, Dartmouth-Hitchcock has said it would serve as an Ebola treatment hub. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that we've acknowledged that we're the treatment hub for a lot of things that happen in the region. We, you know, 40% of our patients come from Vermont as well, so we're actively involved in being the resource for cardiology, for surgery, for pediatrics, for trauma, for a range of things. And we just thought this is our obligation to the Granite State and to the care, and we have excellent coordination with the State Department of Health, and we thought this was well within the spectrum of what we should do. Now, what you should do and how you go about doing it are two very separate things. You need a dedicated facility. You need a dedicated team. We know Bellevue committed over 100 people to the care of one patient.
Wow! Wait, 100 people to care for one patient?
Well, those are the people they recognized in the care of Dr. Spencer at Bellevue. And as we think about what it takes actually to provide this care, you know, it is a different care environment, mainly for nursing. And our dedication is to our nurses who will provide most of the care for these patients if we're ever to take care of them. And the amount of time you can care for a patient during a normal assignment is very different if you're in a biocontainment suit that's protecting you, and the amount of time you can actually spend in the suit in direct care. So you actually have many more people as the shifts shorten to 2 hours. So that's, you need a big team. And we want to make sure that we can still be committed to the other care that we provide to the region while also committing a whole team to care for a very small number of people.
So how many people would be on this team for a potential Ebola patient?
I think we are committed to having at least 50 people that we have identified and we're in the process of training. We will have more. And for us, this is not just about Ebola, to be honest. I think for us, this is about recognizing our ongoing preparation for evolving infectious diseases that will require preparedness and personal protection. And we're viewing this as an investment in how we can be a resource in the future.
Well, and Dr. Montero, to you too, lots of preparations there at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. What about at the state level in terms of both your department and then other healthcare facilities getting ready for this? I'm imagining that there's more attention.
Yes, absolutely. And let me start with thanking Dr. Weinstein and Dr. Marins. What Dartmouth is doing, it is an incredible work, quite complex, as you just heard. And that's the reason why we at the state level don't think or feel that every single hospital should be prepared at the same level. So we have having all of these discussions from the beginning of this event, trying to identify centers that will manage initially the patients. So we have been working, we have had many discussions with the clinical community and the executive community at the hospital level. So we know that a patient under these characteristics may show up anywhere, at an ambulatory practice or at an emergency room. Now that we know that they are coming and we know who they are, it may be different because we can direct them somewhere. That takes a lot of the uncertainty out of the picture.
And it makes sense for one hospital to be sort of the hub.
It makes sense to one hospital to be the hub, but we know that some other hospitals have said that they will do the initial management as well, and they are trying to get ready for that level. What is a little bit worrisome for us is the long-term management of a patient. When we ask,
right, who pays for this?
Well, that's a different discussion. It's a big national discussion with the insurance companies and the federal government. Having to dedicate 50 people to these and closing services has a huge impact in any hospital. But it's not just the bottom line of the hospital. It's the availability of services. It's not as if we have intensive care units, beds there that we can just close because we're
just ready and waiting, right?
So what is the impact of managing a patient like this and at each place in each state? So having a referral system that is maybe federally managed, where some places outside the small states like ours that will do the long-term management will be an ideal solution. I know that as a country, we are not there yet. In other areas in New Hampshire, we have been working with law enforcement. We did trainings for them so they are prepared. We have been working with Homeland Security and Emergency Management, our partners at the Department of Safety. So we work with EMS through them and many other groups, fire departments, so they are ready if we need to transport patients. In this area, we have a private company and the Dartmouth team who had agreed to transport patients as well. And we are doing education of clinicians. And in some places, we will even do community events trying to decrease the perception of risk. So what happens if one of these clinicians come back and we have, as we are experiencing right now, some parents concerned about the kids of these clinicians coming to school? When the cases in Texas happened, we saw schools close in Texas and Ohio. It makes no scientific sense to do that. It makes no scientific sense to be worried about the families from our healthcare workers. It makes no sense to be worried about the children of our healthcare workers. But from us saying that to the public understanding, there is a translation issue, and we are trying to address those. So we are working in many different fronts.
Let's take some calls, gentlemen. And this is Phil in Hanover. Go ahead, Phil. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine.
Good. I think the panic associated with the people who came back from Africa with Ebola is kind of a perfect storm. You have, on the one hand, a lot of Americans who have become less confident in science, which is a tragedy. Two, politicians who want to sabotage leaders so as to gain their own momentum politically. Three, news outlets who want to keep people watching, of course, NPR not included, who want to keep people watching so they can sell more products. And this all went together to create an unnecessary panic and political actions on state levels that were unwarranted.
Phil, thank you very much for the call. What do you think, Dr. Marins? We talked about this earlier in the program, but you weren't with us. This idea that, you know, panic was spread by some who benefited from that panic.
I think that's clearly the case. And I think our message combined with the state is to continue to go back to what we know about Ebola, what we know about its transmission, what we know about everything about it, and to constantly remind people that this is not something you get with casual contact. You only get it when people are symptomatic. And it's been borne out by the cases we've had with the nurse that traveled on a plane and even the man who died in Texas. He got sent home to be with his family, and his family never were infected. So I think we have to base everything in reality and remind people, and I think we'll have some comfort knowing that that's really how things played out, and then go forward. But I think we always have to keep coming back to science and move away from describing disease and preparedness by politicians who have or sensationalized media. I think we have to go back to the basics, listen to our public health department, listen to the CDC, and listen to the experts. So I entirely agree with Dr. Baden's assessment.
Okay. Well, Dr. Marins, thank you very much, and good luck getting that up and running at Dartmouth.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. That's Dr. Ed Marins, Chief Medical Officer in charge of Ebola preparedness at the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon. After a break, more of your calls, questions, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Dr. Montero, I have a couple of Facebook comments that came in before the show that I'd like to share with you. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. Put a comment there. And we'll hear a little bit more about the case of a Maine nurse who attracted international attention after objecting to her treatment in the U.S. upon returning from West Africa. All that coming up in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today, we're talking about Ebola, the facts and fears, and new protocols emerging in the states, including New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions or comments about how this state and others are responding to the fears about Ebola. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dr. Montero, a couple Facebook comments that came in before the program. Two about the flu and how Ebola relates to seasonal flu. Tom says, my biggest concern is how afraid people seem to be of contracting a disease that presently does not exist on this continent, especially among, Tom says, the grossly misinformed people who otherwise repudiate vaccines against genuine health threats. Tom says thousands of Americans die from preventable flu-related causes every year, yet the majority of us have no fear of that virus, let alone pay a few dollars for a shot to prevent contracting it. So that's Tom. Chris has a similar comment on Facebook. He says, why is there no perspective? The flu kills 30,000 people a year, but we're not getting excited about that. Thanks to both of those people for those comments. What do you think, Dr. Montero?
Well, I fully, completely, and totally agree with them. And this is this issue about perception of risk and the fear of the unknown. The flu has been with us for years, so people kind of got used to it. The fact that it kills thousands every year kind of goes unnoticed because it is part of what we have every time. We don't panic about obesity. We don't panic about diabetes, even though 9% of our adults have it and only 2% have them 10, 15 years ago. It's a perception of risk. We know that only 60, 65% of our elderly population, those over 65, get the flu vaccine. We need 100% of them to get it because that population dies with the flu. And we're still not getting them excited around the flu vaccine because it is a routine issue that comes every year. So we want to highlight that message, that we want everybody to be vaccinated with the flu. Certainly, we have key risk groups that we want to emphasize, but part of what we do when we are not a risk group but get the vaccine is help to protect others. And that's part of our personal responsibility to our loved ones. We need to do whatever it takes to help them be healthy. And one thing is getting the flu vaccine.
Let's take another call. And this is Jesse in Pembroke. Hi, Jesse. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for taking my call. The thing that I'm finding real curious about this whole thing with the quote-unquote main Ebola nurse, Casey Hickox, there, is the fact that she's a CDC employee and trained under a two-year CDC intelligence officer program. I mean, she has a direct line and email at the CDC. She's worked for them and put out many publications with other peers over the years. And it seems suspect to me that, I mean, all this is easily verifiable info, but it's just been massively unreported, if not reported at all by the mainstream media. I mean, the fact that we have a highly connected CDC intelligence officer blatantly snubbing CDC quarantine guidelines, I'm just not sure I'm understanding the logic behind that and why that hasn't been a subject that would be of interest to the media. And I guess I would just close with reminding people that since we've repealed the Smith-Mundt Act, it's okay for our government to propagandize and inject false news programming into our system.
Okay. Jesse, thank you very much for calling. And since he mentioned, Dr. Montero, the case that did get international attention of the Maine nurse because she went out for that famous bike ride, even though the state wanted her under quarantine. Let's go now to Patty White. She's a reporter for Maine Public Broadcasting Network, and she covered this case. And Patty, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Hi, it's great to be here.
What light can you shed for us, Patty, on Casey Hickox and her connections to the CDC, whether she, you know, really was connected to that agency, and maybe our caller seems to be saying should have known better.
She was connected to the CDC and also worked for Doctors Without Borders, but the CDC guidelines never called for in-home quarantine. That's what the state of Maine called for. And she was opposed to those main protocols because she felt that they were not based in science.
So CDC guidelines said what that she needed to do?
I believe the federal CDC guidelines said that she should have monitoring of her symptoms, but there was no protocol for in-home quarantine.
I see. So Maine went a step further, and she said, no, I'm following what the federal agency tells me to do.
Right, because she didn't have any symptoms.
So then what happened? Just remind us, if you could, because it's been a little while, please, Patty. The state started off pretty strictly, but then backed off at some point. What was the turning point there?
Well, the turning point was a court order. I mean, it was interesting because when the state knew that Casey Hickox was coming from New Jersey, they implemented new protocols saying that they wanted her to do in-home quarantine. Then she went for that bike ride, and they said, okay, we have these new guidelines where she can go for bike rides or jog as long as she maintains a 3-foot distance. But pretty much other than that, they wanted her to be at home. They didn't want her to go into public. And she did not agree to that. They sought a court order, and a judge said that the state failed to provide clear and convincing evidence that the restrictions they wanted were necessary to protect public health. And the court said that Casey Hickox needed to submit to daily active monitoring by a health worker and report if any symptoms developed. But that was really all she needed to do, was just the daily active monitoring.
And where does this case stand now? Again, it's been a little while. Go ahead, Patty. Where does it stand now with Casey Hickox?
Well, I mean, I guess the chapter has been closed. I mean, Governor LePage, after the court issued their order, he said he didn't agree with it, but he would abide by it. And Casey Hickox said that she would agree to the daily active monitoring. And so basically, that settled it. But since then, you know, Casey Hickox said that she did this mostly because she felt like this was a battle kind of larger than herself. She wanted to protect other health workers returning from West Africa So even though she was, you know, did have the ability to go where she wanted, essentially, she did stay close to home because she also recognized that there was fear in her community.
Is there anything else that jumps out at you, Patty, from this story? I mean, it was kind of interesting for us here in northern New England that this case of this one person made international headlines. I mean, the BBC was all over this story.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, it, you know, the fact that she stood up, you know, to what the state wanted was a big deal. And I guess I think the other thing I would point out is that the state did receive a fair amount of criticism. I mean, the Maine Medical Association and some former state epidemiologists wrote a letter to the local paper, the Portland Press Herald, criticizing the government for politicizing this and sort of not basing protocols on science.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us, Patty. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Patty White. Again, she's a reporter from Maine Public Broadcasting, just updating us on that case of Casey Hickox, the nurse, again, who attracted international attention after objecting to a quarantine after working with Ebola patients in West Africa. You can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Dr. Montero, here's another Facebook comment that came in. This is from Jen. She says, my concern is for the healthcare workers who are on the front lines in West Africa helping out with this disease, being treated poorly when they get home. Jen says that and the lack of understanding in some parts of the country of what part of Africa is affected, the number of cases where people traveling to East Africa or even South Africa being subjected to nonsense like self-quarantines when they were half a continent away from the affected area is astonishing. Jen, thank you for the comment. We've been talking about this all hour, Dr. Montero, but I would like your information and your thoughts again about, you know, where in Africa this is concentrated and whether you have heard of cases like Jen has of people being half a continent away being quarantined. For example, people going on safari in Kenya or Tanzania.
Well, I haven't heard about any specific situation like that at the level of quarantine. But so three countries right now, Liberia, New Guinea and Sierra Leone, New Guinea and Sierra Leone are the ones who are impacted. We are seeing cases in Mali, but it's not clear if we have an outbreak there or not. So we start with West, with some specific section of Africa. And at the federal level and the state level, that is what we look for. At the community level, and in some cases at clinical level, people get a little more anxious and they ask about Africa. And if somebody comes down from a flight with a cold, they get panicky. And it makes no particular scientific sense to do that. Many weeks ago, we had at a school setting a situation where somebody was coming from maybe Abu Dhabi or one of the nothing to do with this, and people was really worried and wanted to take the kid away and send him home, the parents, not the school. And again, that's the place where we come, talk to people, explain the situation, try to decrease their anxiety and do education about it. We need to understand that the situations and the guidelines have changed over time as we learn. This example of the nurse from Maine that we addressed earlier got caught at the wrong time in changing guidelines. And we have a federal system. The federalism means that each state develops their own guidance and their own guidelines to protect their own citizens. So we all may do different things.
I see. That's why it's confusing for people, because the CDC comes up with its own guidelines, but then states like Maine can do what they want.
And you read the CDC guidelines and it says, and each state will develop within this their own criteria and their own guidelines. And early on, and when you have the situation real, the hot situation, you may lean toward being more aggressive in controlling or preventing risk. And you see that at a school level, at a family setting, or at a clinical setting. They go above and beyond what is necessary at that time. But as I said earlier, this bringing together the science of infection prevention with the science of risk communication is a tricky situation to be.
All right. Let's go back to our callers. And Jean is with us from Exeter. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
I just found it interesting that of the six states that put in a quarantine, five of them had a governor up for re-election. And I think that that perhaps played a big part in the fact that they were so aggressive on wanting to be tough on any possibility of protecting their constituents.
What about the fear, Jean? I think I'm hearing from you that you think quarantines are overboard. What about, though, the fear that this could be highly infectious, that, you know, I don't want my kid to get it in school, I don't want to get it from a coworker at work? How do you manage that?
I'm aware of the fact that, you know, there was a survey, and 12% of the people surveyed said that they felt sure that they or a family member would have Ebola at the end of the year, which was really scary given the facts. I think that we are not serious about or looking seriously in scientifically. We're looking at the fear factor instead of the reality factor. So the things we should be afraid of, I'm a nurse, are things like MRSA, which we get at our gyms, things like norovirus, which we can get on a cruise ship, things like Lyme disease, which we can get in our backyard. Those are the things that are the realistic fears and not the publicized fears. And I think that the governors were playing into the fear factor when they put in the quarantine.
Okay. Jean, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of how people feel about this, Dr. Montero, a recent survey found that 75% of Americans believe Ebola health workers should be quarantined. How do you respond to that? How do you feel about that?
It shows that we have a big challenge in front of us to do a lot of education of our public and trying to reassure them on the science of the transmission of illnesses, redirect those concerns to us, the person who just called, the real risk of the diseases that we have here, redirect them to the risk of smoking and obesity and diabetes and the need for a flu vaccine, because there is no ongoing transmission of Ebola in the U.S. There is no community-based risk, and currently we don't have any known cases of Ebola. So how do, when you look at the reality of that, certainly I think that many people is still in what we were a couple of weeks ago, and all the hype and some political hype and all of this initial fear. I think that we are coming down to a better place where people is really understanding that we don't have this big risk. And as we get into the cold months, certainly flu and norovirus are going to be here with us. Just go and get a flu vaccine. That will be really protect you to something that may impact you or your family.
So just to clarify for us one more time again, Dr. Montero, we do have quarantine here in New Hampshire. We're hoping that, you know, you won't have to impose it on anybody, but we do have a quarantine system set up. Jean said that states where the governor was up for re-election did impose quarantines. Governor Hassan was up for re-election. So we do have a quarantine here in some limited cases.
Well, yeah, but the recommendation came from the Department of Health, came from us. It doesn't come. So as you look at our recommendation, it's different from what other states do have. We don't have a mandate quarantine for low or some risk. We are going to work with the people who had a clear exposure with a breakdown in protection. And we're dealing with the bodies of somebody who died with Ebola.
Direct
and concerning exposures. Those are the ones that we are foreseeing in New Hampshire for a quarantine. Or actually the family contacts of somebody who has Ebola and they were at the same house. I do know, and I do acknowledge, based on some experience in Africa or the Texas experience, that those groups, that this particular group, the family members of somebody with Ebola living in the same household, didn't get it. We see that in Texas.
In the Dallas case, yeah.
When I look at that from the community perspective, do I want that population to be out there? I know that they won't. So actually, quarantine will protect them as we diffuse the risk in the community and we advance the education piece. We cannot change public perception overnight. We saw that experience with HIV. Regardless of how wrong that is, we need to help communities move to where they need to be and protect these populations that may face some discrimination. And that's something that we certainly don't want. With healthcare workers, if they were working and they use the PPE, we are not going to force any quarantine on them at all.
PPE is
I'm sorry?
Did you say if they use the PPE?
If they use the proper protection, they can just go on with their lives.
Okay. When they come back, and we, again, New Hampshire has two people over there now, one from the military and one from a healthcare setting, working with patients in West Africa.
Correct. That we are aware of.
Yes.
We know that more are going to be there, and we will work with them when they come back to develop proper plans. And actually, some of these workers that are there, even our own Deputy State Epi, looking at her assessment of risk, regardless of the fact that we said that we can, that she may self-quarantine, we have to do an assessment when she comes back. And it may come out for us to say that maybe she doesn't need it from a technical perspective. Where do we go from a communication risk perspective? We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Okay, Dr. Montero, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having us.
Dr. Jose Montero, Director of the Division of Public Health Services at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. This is The Exchange on NHPR.